Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
On the list for last week, but I don't remember if we got to it or not.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 430th episode of Polycast. I am Canis Albinus, and I'm here with our full cohort today. We've got Makalua.
Did you know 1999 was 25 years ago? Yeah, you can come either feel old or feel ridiculously young with us.
The Mian team.
If volume of fire isn't solving your problem, you don't have enough of it.
And Mega Bears fan.
Now that the NFL season is officially over, I can start saying the Bears are going all the way this year. on to next season.
Well, we can try, right?
I love how the reaction from that was multiple of us just laughing. But you never know. It's possible.
San Francisco would like it to be next season as well. So,
I mean, yeah, pretty much everyone that's not the Chiefs will.
We didn't know how to play overtime.
Well, they clearly didn't. I mean, they showed it.
They just got outplayed. I don't think anything was wrong with their strategy other than they let the Chiefs score.
The criticism is that with the new overtime rules, it overturned the conventional wisdom of NFL overtime strategy, which is you do not want the ball to start overtime anymore. Because if you get the ball first, then you have to make tough decisions on like fourth downs about whether to punt or kick a field goal or go for it. But if you get the ball second and the other team's already scored, then you know you have to go for it on fourth down. So basically you have 25% more opportunities to drive the ball.
You can still go for it on fourth down if you're the first one with it. It's fine.
You can, but if you're in your own territory, it's way riskier.
Now, isn't it still the case where if you score a touchdown, you win on the spot still?
No, they changed it last year or the year before so that even if the first team scores a touchdown, the second team gets the ball back and has an opportunity to tie the game, and then it goes on to sudden death after that. Now,
I guess that's fair then.
Yeah, my big confusion with the rules was I thought that after the 15-minute timer expired, the overtime ended and you went into a double overtime and had to do like the coin toss and everything all over again. I didn't realize that when the 15 minutes expired, they just rolled it over into like another quarter of overtime. So I was like telling everybody that I was watching the game with like, oh my gosh, are the Chiefs going to run out of time? Like, and if they don't score, is that it? Is it over?
I think it would be, right? Like if it's not tied and the time runs out, you just win or lose.
No, again, the rule is both teams have the opportunity to have a full possession. So until the Chiefs turn the ball over with like a fourth down or an actual turnover, like the game would keep going on. So if that 15 minutes expired, that last 3 seconds had run off the clock before the Chiefs scored, they would go into a second overtime period. They would just flip sides of the field and start over with another 15 minutes on the clock. And the Chiefs would be right where they were with an opportunity to score at the goal line.
Those are good rules. I didn't realize the NFL actually put them in, though, since they were so stubborn against it for so long. But I think that's reasonable.
And now back to Civ talk.
Yeah. Welcome to the Civ Strategy Podcast.
Back to our regularly scheduled programming.
Whee!
So this is where we talk about the new February Challenge of the Month from Firaxis. It's a very appropriate Valentine's Day themed story. Basically, you're playing as Cythia on a dual map, and you get to kill Cyrus. Because historically, the way that you deal with Valentine's Day is to go to war with the person who proposed to you, and then cut their head off and stuff it in a bottle of wine, a bucket of wine, right?
Apparently.
So when Civ 6 first came out, I looked into a lot of the new leaders and civilizations, and reading about Temiris in particular, like, became one of my favorite historical anecdotes, like, ever, because I think it's just such a fun and interesting story. Though it needs to be qualified with the fact that there are, like, I think three different accounts of how Cyrus died, and only one of them involves Temiris and Scythia, so there is debate about whether the story about her is apocryphal or not, but I'm going to go with it because it's fun.
At this point, it really doesn't matter because...
No, I look at this. Go ahead.
Because you get to history that's that far back, it could be the truth, it could be mythological, it doesn't really matter because those are what our societies were built on, the story of it being real, so... Whether it's real or not has very little relevance except to the pedantists in history class.
Should we actually go over the story in case any listeners aren't familiar with it?
If you know the story off the top of your head, go ahead.
I think I remember most of the gist. So basically, Cyrus wanted, I guess, to annex the Scythian Empire into, was it the Persian Empire?
And one of the Persian empires, yeah.
Yeah, and he thought the best way to do that would be to marry their queen, Temiris. And she was like, oh, hell no. And so they actually went to war over it. And at one point during that war, Cyrus set out a trap for one of her like recon battalions or something like that, which happened to contain her son as one of the officers. And what they did is they left out an abandoned camp full of wine. And the Scythians... did not have wine. They didn't know what wine was. So they all started plundering this Persian camp and started drinking the wine, having no clue what it would do to them, and they all got crap-faced drunk. And then the Persian soldiers all, you know, basically jumped out of the bushes and ambushed them and, you know, slaughtered them. And when Temiris found out about this, she personally led her cavalry into battle against Persia's army the next time they met, and she pinned them against a river and refused to let them retreat. And according to the stories, she personally went after Cyrus himself, beheaded him on the battlefield, took his body back to her camp, hollowed out his skull, and used it as a wine goblet for the rest of her life as revenge for him murdering her son.
As it turns out,
do not mess with mothers.
As it turns out, don't mess with awesome chicks, right?
Yes.
And do not slaughter their children, because they will slaughter you back harder.
It's a very nice Valentine's Day story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, like I said, there's alternate versions of it. Like, I've also read that some historians think that she actually did accept the marriage proposal. Others think that she refused it, but there was no war. A lot of people say that there probably was a war and her army probably did kill Cyrus in battle, but she probably did not do it personally. She probably just had his, you know, body returned to her, and maybe she used his skull as a wine glass. Maybe she didn't. Like, so, you know, there's a lot of disagreement about what happens, but regardless, it's a very cool story.
So for the actual challenge, we have online speed, domination only. You can play in Prince or Emperor. There's Barbarian Clans on the map, so you can make nice with them. Inland Sea, dual size, online, make nice with them. The Barbarian Clans is the game mode that allows you to...
Well, yeah, I get that there's Barbarians, but what's this nonsense you're talking about?
You can pay them to join you or give you units or ransom units and all that stuff.
That's ridiculous. There's only one way to handle barbarians, and that's not what you do.
Right. It's online speed, so it's a very short map, and you start in the ancient era. You basically just kill Cyrus. It's just you and him on the map.
Inland Sea, which I guess makes sense.
Although, I'm guessing it's either the Aral Sea or the Caspian Sea.
Well, I wonder where the...
I guess the Aral would make more sense, since on the game you can go around it, I'm sure, and settle on either side, and that would be a little bit more plausible than... these empires fighting to the west of the Caspian, so we'll just say it's the RLC.
Yeah.
I wonder if where the relative position of the Inland Sea and the Persian and Scythian starting locations are, because I wonder if the intent behind using the Inland Sea setting was to give the Scythian player the opportunity to potentially pin the Persian military against the sea, with their backs to the sea. As is the case in the, you know, potentially, possibly apocryphal historical anecdote.
I would be surprised if that's the reason, as opposed to just, like, trying to mimic the historical positions of the nations, since they were, in fact, near multiple inland seas.
I'm guessing it's because the battleground between the Persians and the Scythians was that spit of land between the Caspian and the Aral. So,
yeah. I mean, maybe someone thought about the story too, but I think by far the main motivation for that is just to get terrain that would be somewhat representative of the scenario, which obviously means you should use naval invasion.
Maybe, although
horses on boats.
You should just take your unique unit and go kill him. But
well, yes. I mean,
you can make boats if you want.
That is the appropriate method. Horse archer him to death.
Yeah,
but what about horse archers from a boat?
Yeah. It takes too long.
Might as well just use archers on a boat.
I was going to say, what do the horses help supply there? The boat's faster.
It looks awesome. You like have a literal appearance of like a dude on a horse on a boat in the game. That'd be amusing.
I'm actually having visions of like little like not steam wheels, but like little wheels and the horses running inside and driving the boat.
You mean like a horse hamster wheel?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Is a boat a medium creature like horses?
Oh, no.
Sorry, that's a bit off topic, but that's a reference to a game where centaurs are medium creatures and they could ride each other for a little while in the rules. So you'd have like a centaur tower.
Because, mm-hmm. like, the rules allow any character to ride a medium creature?
Well, yeah, well, they were medium creatures, and they were allowed to ride medium creatures. So, you could stack centaurs.
Why would a centaur need to ride
anything? They don't need to, but the rules allowed you to stack them. And so, inevitably, somebody would realize this and try to stack them.
Centaurs all the way down.
Or up, depending on your perspective. So, yeah, go knock heads. This is the correct victory condition, so... all this backstory and whatever, that's just a Cassius Belli, as we call it in EU4. But it does get the job done.
This is a Phil-approved scenario.
Yeah.
Well, except for the part about actually being nice to the barbs.
Oh, Canna said that. There's nothing in the description that says that.
You don't have to. You can just ignore them.
So that's just fake news. Yeah.
But, I mean, like, they can give you military units. So, like, isn't that worth maybe making a little friend?
Well, now, wait a minute. If that happens, then they're no longer barbarian, so it doesn't count.
Well, in barbarian clans, they're not... They're more non-barbarian than they are barbarian. They're barbarian they're at war with everybody,
The important question is, are they my units or are they not my units?
They are not your units.
And if they don't become my units, then they're barbarians, and there's only one way to deal with barbarians.
You can pay them off to not kill you.
You can... Yeah, if I remember correctly, you can rent the barbarian units. It's similar to levying city-state units, right? Like, you get it for, like, 20 turns or something?
No, you can buy the unit, though.
You flat out buy them.
Oh, you just flat out buy them.
You can pay them to stop being barbarians, in which case they are no longer barbarians. You don't have to deal with them like barbarians, but otherwise...
Sometimes the camps have unique units that it's worth buying.
That's true, too. Yeah, they can have unique units. I like the barbarian clans mode. I hope that just becomes the default way that that future games handle barbarians.
I agree.
Nope, Civ is going to completely remove barbarians and replace it with the Beyond Earth aliens instead. Well, even though it's a Civ game. You just have the Beyond Earth aliens in a Civ game.
Well, Beyond Earth is a Civ game as well.
Well, I'll
qualify. But like in the historical setting, like you just have like spearmen fighting those things.
I'll probably say that
that if they want to just completely get rid of the concept of barbarians and replace them with some kind of like just nomadic tribes thing where maybe some of them are violent and aggressive, pillaging and raiding, and others aren't, I'd be fine with that too. Like, but just I think the barbarians should be treated a little bit more like, you know, people and less like wildlife.
That's ridiculous,
because, you know, they're people.
That's what we've been doing in the multiplayer game, is you just put in the one city state because it's the, like, I think that's the minimum you can have, and then we just let all the barbarian clans go around and some of those become the later city states, and it makes somehow that makes more sense to me, that instead of having cities spawning next to city state right in the beginning of the game, it's like, how are you already civilization? You know, then this, you have them develop over time in different places, and it's more real life-ish.
Yeah.
They're not citizens of my empire. They are people.
I guess one way to look at it, Mackie, would be to just say that all of the civs in the game start the game as city states, and the ones that are actually playable civs just happen to be the ones that bother to build more cities.
Well, there you go.
They were given a certain inalienable right. They were allowed to build settlers.
Unless you're Venice in 5.
Speaking of not being allowed to manually build settlers.
Ooh, is that our millennia segue?
Yes, it is.
So I believe we talked last time about how there was an upcoming free demo for the new Paradox Historic 4X called Millennia. And I played it. Did all of you play?
I played it.
I did not.
Yeah, I got in one game with it and I hit the turn limit, so.
Yeah, same here. I went through one game on like a Friday night and then hit the turn limit. And of course, I don't know if they scripted it to be this way, but the turn limit expired just as the game was getting juicy.
Exactly.
Yeah, Grease and I were just starting to get frisky. They forward settled near me and I was like, there were like six turns left in the game. And I was like, you know what? I want to see how fighting other civs works. So I just declared war. I went in and I started pillaging and raising everything. And then, you know, they fought me back and, you know, actually managed to push me out of their territory. And then, yeah, the timer expired. And I was like, boo.
Yeah, I was probably maybe another five turns off of conquering Spain because I random rolled and I ended up a Zulu and I had both Spain and Greece. I mean, Greece first, but they were forward settling towards me. I'm like, no. So Spain had actually declared the early hostilities where you'll fight in neutral territory, but you don't go into each other's territory.
And that is one of my favorite features of Millennia.
Yes.
I love when these grand strategy games let you have small border skirmishes without an official declaration of war, because it creates more conflict and more drama. And, like, gives you more reasons to get mad at the other civilizations and, like, hold grudges and for tensions to escalate. I've always been frustrated by the fact that Civ, like, refuses to let us have conflict in without a declaration of war. Because sometimes it's like, I don't want to fully declare war. I just, you know, I just want to smack them a little bit for being too close to my borders. Or, you know, they happen to have that one settler wandering by. Now, of course, if they're going to let us attack players without declarations of war, then the AI needs to be much friggin' better about escorting settlers and civilian units.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one thing at a time.
Or they accidentally or intentionally put mines in international waters and blow up in a U.S. warship and get their entire navy sunk before war even happens. True story.
We are just full of the historic anecdotes today.
Well, yeah, Iran did this, and the U.S., like, sank their half their navy in an 8-hour workday, and things ensued. But it wasn't a war. There was no war declared.
Yeah, but the fact that you can have this middle range, not in the territory things, but you can chase them off from the area around your territory. But then you still have to, but then I ended up having to declare a proper formal war on Spain because they were just getting too close. And it's like, no. You're right off the border of the second. No, it's right off the border of the town I had extended my capital area, my capital region with. I was like, you're too close. So I was in the process of taking out some of their armies before I went into Barcelona itself. And that's when the turns ended.
So I'm trying to remember like how it worked in the demo. So you can declare hostilities, right? And that allows you to fight in neutral territory, right? Can you enter the other player's territory at that point?
It didn't seem still like I could, because I had a scout unit that was up against a new city they had, or no, a city, a nearby city they had annexed into their border, one of the neutral cities, and I couldn't go in the borders. So I only tested it with that one. I didn't test it with a proper army. It was just my scout cavalry wandering around, although technically a proper army, but you know.
It was kind of funny that, like, the diplomacy on this demo, like, felt like a total just placeholder mechanic. Like, it was not developed at all. Like, you could literally just bring up the diplomacy and there's, like, two buttons. And, like,
yeah,
even when you're at war and you bring up the diplomacy screen, there was literally just a button to make peace. And I just clicked on it and there was peace. Like, there was no, like, negotiation, no trading, no terms, nothing. So I'm assuming this is all placeholder stuff and they're going to develop diplomacy more in, you know, the coming months, at least hopefully. But yeah, even with the diplomacy being as undeveloped as it was, it still had this one really awesome feature that I think should just be standard in all our historic 4X games, is the ability to fight skirmishes in neutral territory, with or without a declaration of war.
We should be able to use our scouts to chase off the settlers or chase off their scouts. And like, no, you can't look at my land. Get away.
Endless Space has something similar, and I think maybe Endless Legend does as well, which is the Cold War mechanic, where you start off, you don't have any diplomatic contact, so you can fight each other, and then you make formal peace.
Didn't the Master of Orion games have some like little bit of fighting or forcing away in the settlement phase?
I believe they did. In fact, I was going to say that the last 4X grand strategy game that I remember playing that allowed border skirmishes without a declaration of war was Star Trek Birth of the Federation, which was like a Windows 98 game that was just a Star Trek clone of Master of Orion 2.
That sounds like a fun game.
It's my favorite Star Trek game. I think it's the best Star Trek game.
I believe
unfortunately,
it
does not work great on modern systems. I've actually been playing it recently, and it always had performance issues. It had issues with a memory leak that would slow it down to a snail's pace, no matter how good your system was, and it would frequently crash. And modern systems, still, it'll still slow down, but worse yet is even without the memory leak, there's like this annoying cursor lag. And
there is a way to fix that.
Yeah, it didn't work on my computer, though, so it may or may not work. I think they recommend running in, like, Windows 98/NT compatibility mode and, like, doing some other settings, and I tried them, and it didn't make a difference for me, at least not on my tablet.
I think the solution is based on a mod fix. So
yeah, there was that, too. I didn't go to the trouble of downloading the mod. I just kind of powered through it. The thing is, I was playing it on a tablet with a touchscreen, so I could...
That would make it much worse.
Well, it was better because I could just point and click at something and don't have to worry about whether.
Well, yeah, I guess the cursor would be better, but I was talking about, I was thinking memory leak problems.
Oh, yeah. I just didn't play the game long enough on the tablet to find out how bad that would get. But the cursor lag wasn't as big of a problem.
I did play the Millennia demo. I did not make it to the end date because I got bored. And that might be because I wasn't trying to kill anybody, but in my experience, it was just move your units around the map and make all of these quote-unquote decisions, which were technically decisions, but they were decisions that, like, I had to navigate through this clunky interface to do. I didn't it definitely does feel like a mana counter, like I was saying last time, but it's not as bad as I was expecting it to be on that front, but it's just tedious. I felt like I was doing things in the game that are much faster in a Civ game and much more streamlined.
Well, I think there's been a lot of comparisons between the Millennia demo and Old World, and people specifically talking about how in Old World there is like an actual action counter that limits how many things you can do in a turn, like right down to how many units you can move. Like you can have a large war going on and you can literally run out of actions and then not be able to move any more units that turn.
I don't think Millennia has that.
Yeah, so that's what I was getting at. Like, Millennia does not limit your actions to that degree. Like, every unit gets to take its turn.
Man, I haven't played around action limitations in ages. An old Super Nintendo game I did a Let's Play of years back has something like that, Genghis Khan 2.
I think it works well in Old World, but that is largely because of the, more limited scope of Old World, because Old World just takes place in that specific time period of like the classical era. It's not, era spanning like Civ. So you don't have like massive armies all around the world, in which case I think it would probably become a lot more of a pain in the butt to deal with. Although, I mean, you could argue that could be realistic because there were logistical limitations to running and managing a large global empire. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it made sense in Genghis Khan as well, but of course that also was scope limited. You were not, like, starting in 4000 BC. You were starting in about Genghis Khan's time, depending on the scenario, and you weren't advancing far past that. And it was like, there was some economy, but the vast majority of what you're doing was making units and you're killing stuff, so... an action limit makes a lot of sense, or at least more sense in a game like that, where, like, it's not mutually exclusive between, like, so much that would go into a Civ game in terms of building things up.
Do we have anything else specific to say about Millennia, or should we move on to the main feature?
I did want to ask how those of you who played it what you felt about the ages system and the fact that there's only like five technologies in an age.
I am not a fan, but mostly because it's different. I think it could be fun, but I don't know. Like, the building system in that game is just, there's too many things to build.
Oh, yeah. Even from the start in your capital region, it's just like, I was really confused on what do I build? You know, so I defaulted to building units because I can go smash somebody if nothing else.
Mackie knows how to play games.
Every tech gives you like five different things you can do or build or something. So you get to the... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's hard to value them because, I mean, it's also because we're not as familiar with the systems, whereas in Civ, we know instinctively what to go to, but nothing seemed to stand out initially, except for maybe like putting your food storage together. And after that, I'm like,
I had that problem too, where I don't want to say that like I didn't have any clue what to build, but just looking through the things, nothing felt like it really stood out as something that I really wanted. I think a big part of that was knowing that the game was going to end after 60 turns, so there was no point in making like real long-term plans for what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So having the full game might help with that.
There's that also one very big thing that I did notice that really affected my ability to decide what to build. Is that when you hover over stuff, the tooltip doesn't really tell you anything. It doesn't tell you anything about any of the yields. Yeah. It doesn't tell you, like, it gives you a little description about what you're building, but it doesn't tell you anything about what it does. So, like, yes, you've got nice flavor text. I see your flavor text, but I want to know, if I build this, do I get more food?
Yeah, what are the consequences of the choice?
I did see that in some things.
It was really small. So maybe some buildings had it and some buildings didn't. I definitely remember seeing some buildings saying, like, this will give you, like, plus one, you know, money or plus one.
And that's the other thing. Even though I know it's the starting era and they're not going to have massive bonuses, plus one felt so weak that I felt off. That's the other thing. I felt I was better off building the unit.
You might well be.
The big thing for me as well was like coming off of games like Civ 6 and also Humankind, where all of your infrastructure is like on the map. I was disappointed that everything was just like in menus in the city, right? Like you don't like the building also felt kind of underwhelming because it's like playing older Civilization games where you just have like the city tile and then all the buildings are just in the city. They're not like on the map. You know, so
I can
where
understand.
You place your buildings.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Oh, I was just saying that, like, being used to Civ 6 and Humankind, where, like, where you place the building physically on the map, like, makes a difference. You know, I missed that, and deciding what to build also felt kind of underwhelming because, you know, where you place it and how it relates to the other stuff that you're building, like, didn't matter, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can understand why they wouldn't want to do that, though, because there are so many different buildings. You would need something like, I don't know if you've ever played the Pathfinder RPGs that are on the computer, but you get like a rudimentary city build screen in that where you can choose where your buildings are in relation to each other and get bonuses from them. That would be like a whole other bonus level that you could get if you had something like that. But I can understand why they wouldn't want to do that because it takes a lot of programming.
And in general, I felt like the city management screen was just kind of hard to parse. Because like when you go into the city, it doesn't bring up like a map where it shows you like all of the tiles that the city owns. They're just like in a list. And yeah, it's like, which tile is which?
I could not.
Two separate tabs.
I could not figure out what I was looking at.
Maybe one day Paradox will figure this out. Like, this is a problem in Hearts of Iron 4 with focuses that you pay for in DLC. They are worse at it than modders in telling you what the consequences of picking this thing in the menu does. Like, sometimes they straight up lie to you, but a lot of times they just say this event happens and there's no way to look up what that event is, so you just take a focus without knowing the consequences unless you've taken it before. It looks like we're getting more of that with these buildings. And if you have fewer techs but more buildings, like, that's you can solve similar complexity to having more techs and fewer buildings. And maybe these buildings interact with each other, and maybe there's really cool interactions with these buildings between each other, but that's not going to be very helpful to people trying to learn the game if you don't have the consequences of them listed in the user interface.
Or
I am, like, starting off frustrated, though, because this is, like, this is Paradox generally can't figure out how to do this for some reason.
I think every technology that I saw unlocked like three or four things. And usually it was like two, maybe like two buildings and then like some other like mechanic or unit.
Yeah.
I also want to say that I'm pretty sure the tooltips were a little bit more informative than Canis was suggesting they were, but the stuff, the yields and things were really small and hard to notice. So I'm wondering, Canis, if you just missed it.
Well,
and I wouldn't blame you if you did.
It is possible because my eyesight does have problems sometimes. But the tooltips always showed whenever it was domain XP, and those are very clearly in the tooltips. But I never saw yields in the tooltips.
Maybe I think that might also be because not every building provided yields. I'm pretty sure there were just some buildings where all they did was just provide you with the domain XP, kind of the way that like a specialist building in Civ might provide you with great people points.
Yeah.
But like no yields. I don't think there are any buildings in Civ that only give you great people points. Unless it's like the garden, I think in Civ 5 was like plus 25% great people points. But yeah, so it might also have been that maybe you were looking at a lot of those buildings that actually didn't provide yields.
I don't know. I got frustrated pretty quickly. I think I only made it to like turn 40.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell because we don't know the
demo.
I never felt like I knew what I was doing or had even any idea what things did.
Well, I'm not totally sure I knew what things were doing, but I knew we had to point an army in the right direction.
I almost felt like I felt almost the opposite. Like, and again, this is coming off of having also played Humankind.
That might help.
And also a little bit of Old World, where to me, Millennia, I thought, felt a lot closer to Civilization than either Old World or Humankind. I think both of those games have a much more like distinct style and flavor to them and play quite a bit more differently. And Millennia, to me, felt a little bit more comfortable, like slipping more into a familiar glove. Like if you had told me that this was a demo for Civilization 7, I would have been like, oh, okay. It's a little bit different, but it still kind of feels like Civ. Whereas like if you gave me Humankind and told me like this was a demo for Civilization 7, I'd be like, oh, they're going in a way different direction.
Yeah, I can see that. I have not played Old World or Humankind, so that might be why I have trouble. Also, I'm not good at learning new things in short periods of time, basically.
Yeah, and that 60 turns flies by real
quick. Yeah, if you can't see the results of what you've done, you don't know what you've done.
Yeah, the limited turn timer means that even if you are building stuff, like you don't ever get that real feedback of knowing whether any of those choices were the correct choice.
Like, I can compare it to when I played the Civ 5 demo, which is still available on Steam, the last I heard, and is a very interesting piece of technology because it is a relic of the original release version of Civ 5, and has all the problems that implies. But when I played that, I was like, this is cool. I understand what's going on mostly. I don't know what everything does specifically, but, you know, it's familiar and it felt good to play. This didn't really feel that good to play to me. It felt like Paradox and Civ were trying to make a baby, and they gave all of the bad things to both sides.
It got all the recessive genes.
Yeah, because it got the Paradox UI and the Civ unit maintenance or unit movement.
Ugh.
Well, other than the fact that all of your units are in armies and you don't actually have like tactical battles, they have that silly battle screen that we actually joked about last time.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, I was still silly very, very underwhelmed by that battle screen.
I was annoyed that I had to click on it to get past the fact that they fought. Just
so,
like, you cut out.
Oh, I was saying, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was done.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just going to say that like it was basically just as we feared, where like, yeah, you have no control over what your units actually do in combat. And one of the things that was particularly frustrating to me was that I upgraded one of my units into a leader, you know, which is this game's equivalent of like a great general that's supposed to buff all of your other units. But that leader replaced the unit that I upgraded. And there's a limited number of units that you can have in an army. In this case, it was only three. And it takes up one of those three slots.
Yeah.
And it's not a combat unit. Like, it sucked. Like, whenever I would get into a battle, because I have no control over what my units do, that leader is in the front line and the enemy units are just focus firing it. every round. Like, it would not survive two battles. It was lucky to survive one battle, and definitely would never survive a second battle. So, like, that's got to change.
Yeah.
Well, when I was having attacks, I was having them focus on the warband as opposed to the leader, and I was annoyed in a similar fashion that I couldn't pull the warband to the back and have somebody else start to be face tanking the hits from the enemy. The enemy always went to the same unit. You're going to ignore the archers pincushioning you in the back? You're going to ignore this cavalry unit? I'm not sure I like that battle necessarily.
Yeah, that absolutely has to change, because there's no way I'm going to want to play the full game if, like, my best units are just out in the front tanking all the hits until they die, and I have no control over that. Especially, again, the leader unit, that is a unit that is a non-combat unit. I mean, it is a combat unit. Like, it can attack and it does damage, it can defend itself, but it's, like, not very strong, and its purpose is to buff all the other units. It should be in the back, right? It shouldn't take up a unit slot, and it shouldn't replace the unit that upgrades. That should just be, like, the leader it comes from the unit.
Yeah, I was expecting it to spawn a leader unit.
Yes, exactly. That it would be, like, a bonus thing that is attached to the army that buffs all the units in the army. That was how I thought it would work, too. And then it wasn't, and I thought, oh, I'm assuming this unit's just going to be really powerful then. And no, it's not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Conquer a couple of barbarian camps and do a few of the goody huts, which the goody hut part is still similar because you're getting different types of currencies or occasionally a unit from those. On one of the barbarian camps, though, it had it was a flavor text about they have some strange, weird technology here. Do we want to sell it for cash or do we want to take it with us? And it turned out to be a early crossbow unit, which buffed that army significantly. You know, and that was part of the army I took to go beat up Spain, because now I have this extra tech that I didn't get before.
If I remember correctly, the goody huts also gave you, like, a choice of two things, or did they just give you one thing?
Usually, yeah, a choice of two things. Sometimes it was currency things. A couple of times I got units out of them as well, normal units.
Lots of domain XP, too.
Yeah, lots of domain XP. Yeah, that was something that I liked. I thought it was cool that you could go into the tribal villages, and also when you capture the barbarian outposts, you get a choice of what your reward is instead of it being just random. That was kind of neat. I could roll with that.
I did also get chaos points out of that to take the crossbows. But I was like, why not? I don't care. I didn't realize I was going to start causing crisis by doing all this stuff, but hey.
Is that what those chaos points do?
Yeah, when it accumulates to a certain point, you start having a greater... Once it gets past a certain threshold, I think it's 30 points, you start having a greater chance of a crisis happening. You can see it up in the top, because you can see the chaos points. And, like, at one point, I had 40 chaos points, and it said there was an 11% chance the crisis was going to happen.
That's pretty
and
cool.
The ages, and the ages also branch. So instead of, like, civilization, where it's just, like, a linear set of ages, you go from ancient to classical to medieval to, you know, Renaissance to industrial, at certain points, apparently in millennia, it can branch. And it's kind of like a golden age or a dark age in Civ 6, where you would go from, what was it, the Bronze Age, I think, and then you could have an age of blood or an age of heroes, and there was, like, one other, I forget what it was. And
it was
it's dependent
age of iron.
On what you do. Yeah, right, okay, yes, right, Age of Iron. So it was dependent on what you do. So if you fight a lot of wars in that Age of Bronze, you trigger an Age of Blood, and everybody goes into the Age of Blood, not just you. So it's like a dark age for, like, the whole world.
But not the world. It only happens if you're the first to unlock the era. So
yeah, which India kept beating me to.
For me, it was the Aztecs getting to the new age first, which were on a totally different continent, so... That's also always kind of silly when stuff that happens that in complete isolation affects the entire world.
I understand that would be hard to code, but it would be really cool if they could separate that based on who knows who.
Well, and
then, but you could like do it by continent or something too, which is more simplistic, but will mostly get the job done.
Well, if you're on an archipelago map, that might be difficult, but...
Well, then everyone gets their own...
Yeah, it could be by diplomatic contact. So if you're the one who triggers the thing, then all of the maybe civilizations that you have contact with at that time would be subject to it, and the ones who don't wouldn't be. But then you have like weird situations where there's possible overlap. And it would be complicated. But, you know, Civilization VI's solution was to just have each civ have its own eras and its own golden ages and dark ages. So,
yeah,
we'll have to see how this goes.
Yeah, it's something that's going to be a real wild card. Like, it could be something that's real fun because it makes every game play a little bit differently because you're going to have, you know, different and unique combinations of ages. Or it could be something that's totally annoying because, like I said, someone in isolation on the other side of the world, you know, trips a flag that puts the entire world into the equivalent of a dark age without any control by the player. So that could suck.
The solution is to do what Mackie did and just put the world into a dark age first. And you can plan for it.
Speaking of Mackie's world.
You mean outer space?
I'm thinking specifically of Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, that's close enough to outer space.
Well, the reason 1999 came up earlier is because back on February 9th, it would have been the 25th anniversary of the release of Alpha Centauri, which we know I like too much. And me playing it and going on forums is how I got here. So, hey, you have another thing to thank Alpha Centauri for, depending on your opinion, I guess.
We always thank Alpha Centauri for Mackie.
I thank it for being there for... because. I always liked it in the beginning because it was like this, it seems like the proper next stage of a game. Like, you got that in Civ 1 and Civ 2, you were launching a ship to Alpha Centauri. So you always wondered, what happened afterward? Well, here you go. This is what happened afterward. I mean,
mind
obviously.
That's what happened.
And in your case, nerve stapling.
Look, once you endure the procedure, you will be happy.
As long as they want you to be happy.
I mean, they're doing what I want. They can be happy doing what I want. It's win-win. One must imagine my subjects to be happy.
But there
as they push that boulder up a hill.
There's a bunch of stuff that is being highlighted on Civ Fanatics right now in celebration of the anniversary.
Yes, because somebody's done an entire fan fiction photo essay, which is like, whoa, I hadn't thought about that before. But yeah, you could do that. You can make up your jump, take the world that was originally created, the story that was created within the game. Which is still one of the things that sets it apart from a lot of the strategy game things, is there's this whole interwoven story that you get a little bit of in the intros and some in the cutscenes and some even in the quotes to go with the technology. So you get, and I believe there was an accompanying set of novels at the time as well. So you got more backstory, more of what was going on between that original seven leaders. I don't think there was something like that for the expansion pack.
I know there was at least one novel.
Yeah, the original novel. With the original seven, but I don't think they did.
Alpha Centauri novels. Centauri Dawn, Dragon Sun, and Twilight of the Mind by Michael Eli and Nish Santago. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, but my brain is losing the plot of those. Cause I know I had the first one. I would have to go digging in some storage areas to find all the old books.
Well, you know, Centauri Dawn, it came out December 1st of 2020 and is currently $56 for a used copy on Amazon, so.
Oh, did it? Oh, okay. So these are newer ones. I know there was a tie-in originally, but those are new ones. Okay.
No, these are 2000.
Oh, 2000. I thought you said, okay, my brain.
I might have said something different.
Somebody's brain. Yeah, unfortunately, one of the sites that has a lot of the patches and a couple of other good tidbits is AlphaCentauri2.info. That one is apparently down, according to thread.
It's down, but if you read the bottom of the thread, you find out that they are actively working to bring it back. They hired somebody to do, like, the reason it's down is because the host is not answering their replies. So he needed somebody who had technical skill. The owner of the site needed somebody who had technical skill to fix the cloud backup stuff. And they found somebody who is working on it. So hopefully that will be back within the next couple of days, weeks, or months. But,
yeah, this is the problem with liking a game that's 25 years old. The fan sites that were up back then sometimes were on sketchy or other kind of hosts. And, well, sometimes the information does not stay. You can probably go through the Internet Archive to find some, though.
The most recent archive was from sometime last year. So it does exist on the Internet Archive.
Yeah. Considering a lot of the mods and stuff would be from earlier, you're probably okay, unless you were looking for a forum post about some very specific technical issues, which trying to get it run on modern machines you know, like we were talking earlier with the Star Trek Birth of the Federation. Yeah, sometimes it's a little bit of a pain in the butt.
Definitely worth it, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And I know, was it last week we were talking about that? Or last time? I say last week, last episode. We were talking about there was somebody trying to make a port. Oh, yes.
They're trying It's in the list of things that they've got on the front page, where it's the most recent implementation / remake has a new version that has just come out with a functioning multiplayer lobby and connection, which is an update from when we talked about it the first time 2 episodes ago.
Okay, so they are progressing in their steps pretty well so far.
No, 3 episodes.
3 episodes.
It was the first episode of the year.
That sounds like pretty solid progress in a fairly short period of time for a fan project.
Yeah, I was expecting the steps to take, at least the first few steps to take longer than that, but no,
yeah, all right. These sorts of things usually have glacial progress.
Mostly
because
that's
lightning progress comparatively.
They're mostly...
Like going back to Birth of Federation, there were people who were trying to make an unofficial sequel to the game, and I would check in on that periodically, and like for years there would be almost next to no movement, and eventually I think it got canceled and they stopped working on it, so there's only like a... I think they ever only had like a partial beta working, but never a full game.
It's usually how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, things happen. You know, the people have other priorities, you know, work, family stuff comes up, you know, teams break apart. It happens.
Yeah. Fan projects, sometimes they go really quickly. If it's set up good initially, they go really quickly, but a lot of them, it's just.
Yeah. Or and then there might also, you know, be cease and desist letters, you know.
Oh yeah, because there's an older RPG series that people have been trying to remake. They've had a couple of successful remakes that didn't get seasoned, assisted. But anyway, now whole other topic. Don't get off on that. We're talking about Alpha Centauri.
We just have to mention EA owns the rights and blah.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem with Alpha Centauri things. It's like. Yeah. I'm glad those guys are having the progress, but I'm almost, part of my back of my brain is waiting for EA to pull out the cease and desist letters.
And what's frustrating is they'll probably wait until it's complete and ready to be released, and then they'll slap them with the cease and desist. And if us as players are lucky, they might take that and release it themselves and sell to us, so we at least still get to play it, but then that sucks for the people who actually developed it.
Yeah, unless they get some form of compensation for that. At least something for their time. I know they're doing it out of the love of the game, but, you know, if you're going to get it taken away and not be able to distribute it to the general public you wanted to for free, most likely, come on. Jeez. Fan project.
Well, easy solution. Just change the name to Beta Centauri, and we're good, right? No cease and desist.
Or Proxima Centauri. Hey, you know? Yeah. One of those. Exactly.
Or Beyond Earth 2?
Well... You'll get a different.
Take-Two might not care if they did that, you know.
Unless Firaxis finds it sufficiently entertaining.
I'm not going to tell anybody how I found this or where I found it, but the Alpha Centauri books are available on the internet. But I'm not going to tell you how to do it because reasons.
Yes, there are various quote library sources in the sense that you can go get those books from.
There's also
you can also get a lot of educational books from those places.
Yeah, there's also an Alpha Centauri GURPS book, which...
remember that being a thing.
Knowing what I know of GURPS may or may not be a good thing.
It was a very it's a very flexible system. It could work. If you wanted to roleplay, you were one of the units on the ground for one of the factions or something like that. I could see that being an interesting RPG campaign.
I'll have to talk about it with the group of RPG players that I know. See if they have any opinions on GURPS that aren't hate it.
But what we're saying is, even 25 years later, there's still a lot of love, there's still a lot of content, even if it's a pain in the ass. You should play it because it is different from what you're used to in 4X games now. Beyond Earth was... Beyond Earth, I warmed up to more later. If I stopped trying to think about it as them trying to do Alpha Centauri and just a separate game, then I liked it better, even if it did have some repetitive. So.
And again, I always want to emphasize that the expansion was actually pretty good.
It was just
for a Beyond Earth.
It was one expansion pack from being a great game.
Yeah, but yeah. That we said that. I think it was Dan that started that phrasing. He's like, just one more pack, and that could have been great. But there wasn't enough support, so
I think it's still of us were going, good.
Yes.
Silent. Should we move on to the Senate, or do we have anything else to say about Alpha Centauri?
refresh my memory, is I believe Alpha Centauri is not available on either Steam or Good Old Games, right? Like, it's not something that you can legally acquire.
It's
right
on
now.
Good Old Games. It is there.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And you can get it on the EA app, I think. You used to be able to get it on Origin. That's where I had my first copy of it. But EA Origin is now gone, so I don't know. But Alpha Centauri is still available from EA somewhere.
So you can still legally purchase and play it.
Yes.
Yeah, I recommend Good Old Games, because they aren't going to steal your data the way that EA does.
And do you know, like, is Good Old Games, do they just give you, like, an ISO of the original game disc? Or is it, like, an updated, like, executable that runs on modern systems? Like, how does...
It depends.
Any idea?
Depends on the game. Sometimes they add mods into the game. Like they'll put... There are some games that the devs will just be like... Or the store will be like, oh, we'll just add this patch so it works. And some of them, they aren't that way. So I don't know exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know how well it would run on your given system if you buy it from Good Old Games. Hopefully it runs just fine, but...
It's not one of those situations like some old games where you cannot play it no matter what. It will work, you just have to figure out the way to massage it a little.
Yeah, maybe run in a compatibility mode.
Or three.
Get used to 4x3 aspect.
And really weird mouse controls.
Oh.
I get reused to 4x3, because there's a time that's all I used, because it's all that was available. It's been a long time since that point, however.
The joys of old games before, you know, modern mouse and keyboard controls became standard conventions.
Playing the Tomb Raider remaster, tank controls!
Is that what that has?
Yeah, because I've been watching a streamer who's done a lot of Tomb Raider playing the remasters, and he was having such trouble with that.
Is there not even an option to use, like, a more modern control? Because, like, even the Resident Evil remake had an option to... in fact, the Resident Evil remake was really cool, because what they did is they mapped the tank controls to the directional pad and, like, you know, more modern, what's called two-dimensional controls, to the analog stick. So you don't even have to go into a menu or settings to change it. You just... If you want the tank controls for a particular reason, you just use the D-pad. And if you don't want the tank controls, you just use the analog stick. They're both right there in finger's reach. It's really cool. Compromise.
Yeah, I would think it would have something like that, because I know I play the originals on the PlayStation, so I know they're somewhere in the... I don't know if that's something particular because it's on PC.
I would think that would work, at least for the first Tomb Raider, maybe the second one, because that was like a very early PlayStation 1 launch title, before the PlayStation 1 even had the analog stick controller, because, you know, showing a little bit of my age, the PlayStation originally launched with just a digital controller that just had a D-pad and no analog sticks.
Yeah.
And it was like a year or two into the system's lifespan before they released the an updated controller with the analog sticks. So those first couple of years of PlayStation 1 games didn't even have analog stick support, so there wouldn't even have been anything on the analog sticks for the Tomb Raider control mapping. So you would think that they could have done the same thing that Resident Evil did, which is just have the tank controls on the D-pad and... give you the option to use, like, more modern style controls on the analog stick, because there's, like, no conflict, right? Because that analog stick didn't exist on the original controller.
Well, it could be they just pulled the Tomb Raider 1 code, which wouldn't have... It was there so early, it wouldn't have had that in. And maybe when he gets to Tomb Raider 2, it'll be better. So I'll see as it go along.
Yeah, and again, to be fair for the Resident Evil remake, it was, like, a full-blown remake. Like,
yeah,
this not does, just a, re, not just
yeah, this
a remaster
has some
or a
button,
port, so.
Yeah, this was like slap modern textures and some modern lighting into the old levels and their geometry for the most part. It didn't look like much had changed necessarily, so.
It's kind of amazing that we need to distinguish between a remaster and a remake.
And then there's also reboots, which don't necessarily fall into either of those categories.
It usually wouldn't.
Those are usually new products entirely.
Yeah, because there was also
like using
a Tomb Raider that
the same
was a
IP,
reboot.
But completely new product under context of the same IP. Okay, just making sure. This one comes from Reddit, one of my stomping grounds. Mostly game Reddits. Ugh. Always seem to be neglecting the Government Plaza early displays. Large benefits. I just kind of overlook it. When and where should I build it? Capital. Addresses us as capital, and this is from 45% Tremor Combo. And there's different advice in the thread. At least for me personally, I do make an effort to build that early because it gives you full bonuses. I never really thought like about where generally. I think it does wind up in my capital decent amount of the time. I'm mostly building it just to take advantage of the adjacencies it offers and get the bonuses. And often I value that over like very long-term optimization, mostly because I'm looking to go knock heads.
Those buildings in the Government Plaza are very good and are mostly early game benefits. So the earlier you build it, like the more use you're going to get out of those buildings. Like one of them, I think, is like a discount to settler costs and stuff like that. But like if you've already settled all your cities, like no point in building that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm used to the AI squeezing me so much that I tend to go for one of the others just because any cities I've built are going to be placed probably before the Government Plaza is viable to put up.
The basic idea, according to JNR13, who is a modcast guest from years ago, he says, when ASAP, where first or second city, and where and whenever I can chop it in the near future. Really just build it where I can the fastest.
Yeah, I think that's pretty reasonable. Like you'll try to place it somewhere within that criteria that you can get adjacency out of later. But if you can't, then you just put it. But you can usually figure out something where later on you can like throw it out another district and you'll benefit as well. But yeah, you want it early one way or another.
Yeah, it is one of those things I always forget about. And then I'm looking at later that usually I've been using my capital to turn out army and settler and letting the other cities take care of other types of buildings, except maybe library.
It's tough because like the capital's a nice city generally. So like you want to grow it, but you like at first it's literally the only place you can build settlers. And even for a little while after that, they'll take ages if you build them somewhere else. So yeah.
And on top of that, I mean, one of the primary benefits of the Government Plaza is that it provides an adjacency buff to all the other districts around it. And your capital is most likely to be your highest population city, which means it's the city that's going to support the most districts, which means you're going to get the most out of those adjacency bonuses because you're going to have more districts around the Government Plaza. Although the Government Plaza itself does count towards that cap. So, you two steps forward, one step back kind of situation. But like, yeah, you're unlikely to get much benefit from it if you build it in your second city, just because you're not going to, you're going to have a smaller population. You're not going to have as many districts. So unless you end up with some kind of situation where like your second city is on like a floodplain with like a bunch of wheat or something like that, and it's going to grow super fast, then you're probably better off putting it in your capital.
I think it depends.
Place it near a river so that it can get adjacency with commercial hub easily. Sure. And if you do that, your commercial hub will at least have 3 era score, maybe more, and or 3 adjacency, which gives it an era score boost. Place it near a lot of woods so you can get adjacencies with your industrial zone.
Yeah, but don't be like the one poster in the thread and end up not building it because you're focusing too much on trying to get it into the perfect spot, for all the adjacencies.
Yeah, I think a better rule of thumb is as soon as it's available, find the thing that's closest to one of those that we just said and put it there.
I've been watching.
You could squeeze it between your city center and the campus, put it there. You could squeeze it where you want to put a commercial hub later, put it there.
I've been watching a lot of City Skylines videos from a YouTuber called City Planner Plays, and something that he says often is don't let perfect be the enemy of good. And I think that rule applies in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Applies in real life too.
That is a thing that all of our governments could learn a lot of things from.
Yeah, even if you're not putting your Government Plaza in the perfect, ideal spot, if you're building it earlier, that means you're getting more yield from it sooner. So, and that has, snowballing effects.
Not even talking about how good the buildings are.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned the buildings, but we're mostly just talking about, like, adjacency bonuses and stuff like that. So,
no matter where you build it, you can build the building inside of it. So, it's like,
right.
Like you want those. And that's why you want it early. But Like, beyond just making sure you build it early, that doesn't impact your strategy too much.
Doesn't the government plaza also give, like, a Eureka bonus for the first civic that unlocks all the governments?
I think it comes from that one.
Oh, okay. I remember there also being something where...
No, do you know what? I think I'm wrong. I think you're right.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then that's another reason to want to build it earlier, because then you get your governments earlier as well.
Yeah.
So you get those extra, you get more policy slots.
I'm blanking on that one, I'm sorry. If you are Sweden, always build it fast, because your unique building is there.
Yep, that's true. Ooh. Or, oh, also, I was going to mention, in contrast, the diplomatic quarter, that's a district that you can wait on.
I don't know, if you're good with city-states, that's a pretty powerful building.
Yeah, so I mean, unless you are playing a city-state-focused civ, then yes, you want to prioritize that a little bit more. But in most cases, the diplomatic quarter is nowhere near as much of a priority.
It can be really good, though.
Also, in most of my games, I don't really need that much help in maintaining relations with all the city-states I want.
Well, no, the stuff you get from the city-states comes through the Chancery, which is in the diplomatic quarter.
I mean, the government plaza is almost like... It's basically Civilization VI's equivalent to, like, every national wonder in Civ 4 and Civ 5.
They just Civ 4 put them all national in one wonders were kind of ridiculous because of the multiplier they applied. Like, the way they scaled with City Earth is a little different. It was a big part of why people could like liberalism before 580 and stuff.
Guess what, boys and girl? We're out of time.
So it seems. Sorry. Get out.
No, not Majin. We will gently massage people out the door rather than kicking them out with a foot.
All right. Well, I'm putting on these gloves with a little bit of padding. So now turn around, bend over, and thank you for joining us on podcast episode 430. As I am the me and team and our guest co-hosts, what the heck am I talking about? A regular co-host, Candace Alvinus.
It's been a while since we've had a guest co-host, although we might have one soon.
Fakalua.
I think I and Phil both need to go find some cosmic caffeine, yep.
And Mega Bears fan.
Uh-oh.
Mad Jin didn't just kick you out with one boot. He would do like a Captain Kirk drop kick to get people out.
Maybe he's the one that had the gloves. Jesus. Well, at least I can be the guest co-host.
He reversed gravity to get us all out of the swimming pool.
Oh, no. I think we did good.
Yeah.
Hurrah.
Hopefully I was semi-coherent with all the office and tourists.
What we need is just more alcohol while we're doing the show.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
That's right. A drunk episode.
That is one thing I have not done yet.
I'm afraid that would just turn into a nightmare for me because I don't drink. It's just like, oh, well, I gotta corral these crazy people. Probably not something we'd want to do.
No.
Unless you're actively trying to get sick, I recommend against it. Because that's the most likely thing is you'll just throw up. And as long as you don't drink after you throw up, you probably won't get alcohol poisoned. But yeah, so don't do that. Don't like throw up when drinking and then drink more. Although I'm pretty sure nobody here would do that. Nobody here binge drinks anyway. But that is how people get themselves into trouble in a lot of cases.
And binge drink water. Does that count?
Unless water is alcohol, not really.
Well, could get water poisoning, but I don't think you're drinking that.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, if you drink enough water, it can kill you. But
yeah, we actually had that happen quickly. In the news many years ago here in Vegas. There was a radio show.
Oh yeah, I remember that one.
It did some kind of contest in the middle of the summer to like chug like a gallon of water or something like that
to earn a Nintendo Wii when they were super scarce.
Yeah, right. Yeah, back in that day, and yeah, some like college kid like did it and like literally died of water poisoning, or maybe had to go to the hospital. Maybe he didn't die, but came close to dying.
Someone died from doing that. I don't know if it was that case or similar.
I think
someone called in and said like, don't do this, it's dangerous, and then they did it, and well,
I think it was actually a mom who died. It was really sad.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, my memory is that the person did die from it, but I could be wrong. But
well, I'm sure it happened more than once.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it can happen. PSA, don't drink too much water.
Not at once, yeah. A gallon of water is fine, even across the day, but not in like 30 minutes.
Not in 30,
not chugging it.
Not worth it. You don't need that Wii that badly.
Well, that's what scares me about those huge water bottles they sell on Amazon, because I'm afraid somebody's going to try and check one of those.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.